Okay, we're talking about the Jesus touch, learning the art of relationship from the Master. And in the most recent classes, we've been talking about looking at the wedding feast at Cana and Jesus' involvement in that whole event. And we saw last time in this part of our study, we were talking about Jesus being available to people, which was part of his one of the tools in his toolbox, his availability, and how just looking at the whole scenario of Jesus at a wedding feast and just being amongst people in just regular normal events in the course of people's lives, that Jesus would actually go and party, okay, is not a way that we typically think of Jesus. You see, we like to tend to think of Jesus as, you know, just the deity part, kind of, as we've talked about before, kind of, you know, walking on the earth, but not really, you know, kind of hovering just a little bit above the ground so he doesn't get his holy feet dirty, you see. But the reality is, he was flesh and blood. And Jesus was all about people. And so we find Jesus at this wedding feast where he's, you know, he's there with people enjoying the event. And we one of the things that we mentioned in that was just the whole idea of Jesus being invited to the wedding feast to begin with. Most likely has to do with his availability to people, that he was a people person. We talk about his sensitivity, which was another tool in his toolbox. Just the idea that Jesus was sensitive to the culture. He knew what was expected out of the culture. And he finds himself in this situation where the bride and the groom run out of provisions for their guests, which is socially a disaster. You see, and Jesus, being sensitive to the needs of people in the culture, was willing to step in to that situation and do something about it. We left off in talking about the part where, you know, Mary comes to Jesus and tells him, you know, what the situation is. They've run out of wine. Jesus' response to his mother, dear woman, why have you involved me? My time has not yet come. So in a sense, it kind of sounds like, you know, Jesus is, you know, look, woman, don't bother me. I've got, you know, more important things to do. But not really. It doesn't seem to really be that that's what's happening. I think Jesus is making a statement, in a sense, about, you know, what he is about. He's about people, but at the same time, Jesus' ministry is not just some arbitrary, you know, make it up as you go along kind of a thing. You know, let's see, what am I going to do today? Oh, I think I'll get up today and maybe I'll do my first miracle and change water to wine at a wedding feast. Jesus' mission was thought out and planned out by the Father, and he was doing what the Father wanted him to do, you see? So it wasn't just this arbitrary, as I said, make it up as you go along from day to day kind of a thing. He had an agenda, and that agenda was helping him to move towards the ultimate purpose that the Father had sent him for. There was not this series of random events in the life of Jesus that just, you know, one day to the next, never knowing what was going to take place, but everything was moving according to God's purpose and God's timetable, which then kind of brings us to this whole situation of Jesus, this statement that he makes to his mother, my time has not yet come, indicates that there was a necessity to deviate from the agenda. Okay, my time has not yet come, but I'll go ahead and take care of it anyway. In other words, here's the situation, I think. Again, when you put all of this picture together and you realize, as we've said, Jesus is here for people. Okay? He's interested in what's going on with people, but at the same time he has an agenda, right? Well, the circumstance in this situation seems to be one where the needs of the people, in a sense, are kind of clashing with the agenda. So how do you know when to deviate from the agenda? Okay? And so I think that what we have to do is we have to consider it in this way. Since Jesus was all about people, that's what his ultimate agenda was all about. It was about people, not just stuff. Okay? Since his agenda really was focused on people, when people were in need, then Jesus was able to put his plans on hold or to adjust them as necessary. You know, we have to look at that as that sometimes when our plans that we have, and we, I think a lot of times can get, you know, we have an agenda, don't we? You say, and we've got our things that we've got to do and so forth. But when our agenda or our plans push people aside, then we need to go back and re-look at and revisit our agenda. See, because people are always more important. And here's the question for us to look at. How did Jesus know when to deviate from the agenda and when to stick with it? Okay. There's two suggestions here, or two questions that Brother Lynn Anderson puts forward in evaluating a situation that I think, you know, you can look at with Jesus in this situation, and it's something I think that would be helpful to us in looking at situations in our lives. We have an agenda. If we're trying to live our life for God's purposes, you know, when do things really, when do we have to change things? And we used the example, I think last week was talking about, you know, we're on our way to church. You know, we got to get to church, right? And we don't want to be late for church because, you know, we're supposed to be here. We want to be here and so forth. But on the way, we see somebody, you know, stranded on the side of the road that obviously needs some help. Do we stop and help that person, or do we make sure we get to church on time? You say, two questions. The first one, he says, is this a true emergency? Okay, whatever the situation or circumstance is it a true emergency? And the reason that's an important and valid question is because not everything that is presented to us is a true emergency. Okay, there are some things that are just long-standing problems that are dressed in panic. Okay. They've been going on for a long time with someone, but right now, all of a sudden, they're panicking over it, so it becomes an emergency, you say. And because it's an emergency to them, they expect it to be an emergency to everyone else, you say. I have a sign in my office that kind of, you know, addresses that issue. It says, lack of planning on your part does not constitute an emergency on my part, okay. Because you didn't plan properly and you didn't prepare properly, and now all of a sudden, you know, you're overwhelmed, does not all of a sudden make it my problem and my emergency. And sometimes, you know, we can help people out in those situations, but sometimes when we jump into those situations that aren't true emergencies like that, then what we're really doing is enabling someone to keep on being irresponsible. And so sometimes what we've got to do is to really look at and evaluate a situation and ask that question, is it really a true emergency? Okay. Or is it something that's been ongoing for a while and it, you know, it's not the emergency that the person or people are really presenting it to be? The second question is there anyone else who could and should meet this need? Is there someone more capable or more qualified to handle this than I am? You say? And if so, then perhaps what I need to do is to pass it on to that person, get them involved in it. You see? Because if I try to deal with it and I don't know what I'm doing, I'm liable just to make the whole thing worse. You see? So he suggests those two questions are vital questions to look at. In other words, in the second one, we don't have to tend to everything that is presented to us because sometimes we're not really qualified to deal with it. But we need to ask these two questions in different situations that are presented to us that way and to be able to evaluate, okay, is this something that I need to deviate from, you know, my agenda on, or is it something that, you know, I don't really need to be focusing on, or it's not as much of an emergency. I don't need to drop everything I'm doing right now and, you know, and deal with this. Okay. So Jesus is presented with this situation. They have no more wine. Okay. Was it an emergency, do you think?
To them it was.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's not a situation that you can go down to your friendly ABC store, you know, on Saturday night and, you know, stock up on more wine. Okay? It just wasn't there. Okay? So yeah, it probably in that sense, yeah, it was an emergency, and in the sense also that, again, as we've talked about, the cultural aspects of this whole thing made it very problematic for these folks. Okay? Then you look at the second question, is there someone else or anyone else who could handle that problem? Say, wasn't anybody else that, you know, you have a wine dealer sitting there, you know, going, oh, by the way, I've got some extra, you know, gallons of wine here. I'll sell you for a price. No, wasn't available, apparently. Okay? Was there anybody else there that could make that provision? The answer is no. And I think we can reasonably conclude that because if there was, then I don't think Jesus would have performed the miracle if there was another resource available. Okay? So Jesus then deviated from his agenda and he handled and took care of this need. We see Jesus then also as being helpful, which is another one of the tools in his toolbox. He met a practical need, basically, is what we're talking about. Okay? There was a need that was there, and Jesus met it. He actually did something about the situation. Okay? He had the servants fill the water jars, excuse me, and bring them to him. And Jesus made about 120 gallons of wine. And it wasn't just any wine. It was the best wine. Okay? Yeah, it was quality. See? And so Jesus, on this occasion, met, I think, what we could reasonably call a very practical need. We don't see a debate. There's no debate about, you know, the rights or wrongs about Jesus making alcohol. All right, I think he left that up to us to debate, you know, and has been for centuries, you know. It's been debated, you know, and so forth. Was Jesus right or was he wrong? Did he really make wine or was it grape juice? And all those other kind of silly issues that people have been debating. Yeah, Jesus wasn't concerned about all that. He saw a need, and he met the need. It's that simple, you see. He saw people in a jam, so to speak, and he knew that he was the only one that could help in that circumstance, in that situation, on that occasion, and so he did. See? The host, because of Jesus' actions, the host got off the hook, the bride was blessed, and the ruler of the feast got a reprieve, as Brother Lynn Anderson evaluates, and I like that. See? In other words, you know, when you look at this story, you know, I think sometimes people have gotten, you know, have lost really what the story is really all about in debating the whole issue of whether or not Jesus really made wine and why did he do that and was it right, was it wrong. I mean, hey, you know what? I'm not going to tell God that what he did was wrong, okay? You know, he wanted to make 500 gallons of wine. That's his business, okay? And he had his reason, he had his purpose. And I think as we've been seeing here, as I've said, I think the purpose is just quite simple. There were people that had had a need, and Jesus met that need. Okay? And we can get into the discussions and the debates and all of those things about the issue of the alcohol and try to justify drinking by it or try to, you know, come up with reasons and excuses for Jesus as if he needed them and so forth. But I think we totally miss the point of the story when we do that. Okay. Any thoughts or comments there at all? Pat? Yeah, it's neutral.
It's how the person handles it. And that's how I was realizing that when we were talking, you know, for one, you know, it's not whether that was a sin or not a sin, it's just how they sin.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I agree with you. Chuck?
With the loaves of bread and the fish, they, someone could have eaten. And, you know, they were lucky about it. And they ate as much as they wanted. They were plenty left over, too. So,
oh yeah. Well, you know, and we've go ahead, Ted.
I've studied quite a bit about the tradition of that time. Weddings sometimes lasted a week. We can't imagine that.
Yeah.
We just don't do that. 2 hours one day.
Yeah, how long do I have to put up with these people at this wedding reception, right?
A whole week. I can't imagine how they carry that out and what they did. And that's one big long party.
Yeah, absolutely.
And traditionally, they dance. They had a happy time. Now, I don't think it was drunk and disorderly. So, normal. I mean, it could be, I guess, but the good folks.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, the problem is, oh, Ray, you got something? Go ahead.
I would like to do what Phil was mentioning. I don't believe our Lord would have anything that's permanent for folks to act upon it. So I'm sure it was good, and I'm sure it was. You always comment that it was the best that they had. And you make the lead, as you mentioned. And that's just my thought on it. Mm-hmm. I just don't believe it was anything that was permanent.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, I understand that, but there's really no reason to believe that it's not, that it wasn't.
Not to the point where I like to think that it wasn't to the point where the people. It's just like, I don't want to say, there are different truths of stuff.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
In the days turn.
Right.
Now, I don't know, I can't say that he didn't, that it wasn't, but I say I don't believe that it was one for that.
Well, if you go back and you look at it, first of all, you know, we read throughout the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament. What does the Bible say about drinking, about alcohol?
Yeah.
Doesn't condemn it at all. What does it condemn? Drunkenness, okay? Which puts the responsibility of the drinking on who? On the individual person, okay? And so, you know, even when we read, for instance, Paul's instructions to Timothy and Titus about elders and so forth, statement in there that elders are not to be given to much wine, right? Okay? Well, if he's not talking about fermented drink, how much is too much grape juice for an elder to consume?
Yeah.
You see? You know, so we have to understand it. In the culture of that time was, it was alcohol. It was fermented drink. You know, and so, you know, but to accept that, you know, that's what they drank was alcohol does not necessitate someone getting drunk on it, you see. And the fact that Jesus made it does not in any way, shape, or form make him someone who is contributing to the drinking problem of somebody else. It again, you know, it's a matter of, as God gave us when he created us, a free will, you see, and up to every individual person to, you know, do what they're going to do and be responsible for what they do, whether they drink or don't drink, and how much they do or don't drink, you see. And so I think that, you know, with all of the evidence that's there, the cultural evidence, we have to conclude that, yes, it was fermented drink. And did God create a problem? I think only for us, you know, because it makes us really uncomfortable to think that, well, you know, he made alcohol and so people are going to be drinking it. Well, yeah, he did, you see. What people do with the things that God makes does not make God the one who created a problem, you see. People take that with everything. Chuck brought out food. Okay? People misuse food all the time. We talked about, you know, in the study earlier, we talked about sexuality. God gave us sexuality as a gift for married couples. But people misuse it all the time. Is that God's fault? You see, we have to look at it in that kind of way and understand it in that way. Brian? Absolutely.
They don't have an issue with drinking from wine. So we tend to add our culture to God's Bible. And that's not all.
Yeah, we interpret the Bible oftentimes based on what our experience is and our culture and so forth. I mean, I mentioned this, you know, a while back, way back when we were, you know, regularly going over to Ukraine and so forth. Our brethren over there, for communion, they use wine. It's not grape juice. Okay? Why do they do that? Well, no, you can find grape juice, but the Bible tells us about the Lord's Supper, and what does it tell us they used? Wine. Okay? And so they look at it and go, well, it says wine. That's what we need to use if we're going to follow what the Bible example is. It doesn't say grape juice. And the understanding is that's what the culture was. It was wine. So they used fermented wine in communion. I haven't noticed anybody kind of holding on to the cup, you know, a little bit longer than they should or anything like that, you see. But to them, it's just the purity of what the Scriptures teach. You know, it says wine, so that's what they use, you see. Our culture, we've had people that had a problem with that. They go over there and there was they're using real wine, you know. And again, the problem is that we're trying to put our culture, you know, upon them, and no, it doesn't fit, you see. Okay, I got hands all over the place. We've opened up a Pandora's box here. All right, let's just kind of work this way. Chuck?
Well, I think what we see in the culture is if you go to a wedding where alcohol is served, there is somebody who will be drunk. Mm-hmm. It's going to be the uncle. You know that one is in
the You know my uncle?
Yeah. It seems like every wedding I've gone to, it's going to be somebody. And we picture that wedding, and we picture Jesus enabling that person. Because we certainly would, I never want to be this other doctor. I don't think you more, but I wouldn't, if I did moderately, I wouldn't want to go into front of that person. Making it okay for them drinking a beer with them while they're stumbling drunk.
Right.
I think that's what we struggle with this story. If we're thinking, yeah, there was some people getting drunk with that thing.
Yeah.
Why would they need so much wine to do it?
Yeah. And that?
About early life and the decision that he did not have over time
Exactly. Okay. Tim, did you have something?
Yeah, I was just the mentality of what you were talking about as far as, and I just got to thinking that as a culture, how just it's our nature to think overindulgence in that sense.
Yeah.
Like no other people in the world, when we think of something, we don't think of the normal fact. We think, this end, that thing.
Yeah.
It's like a normal train of thought, which is, it speaks volumes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I kind of, you know, one of the things I kind of wonder if the bride and the groom ever really knew what Jesus had done for them. But I think
not.
The big picture of the whole lesson is it showed Jesus' power. He definitely did. But I also thought the lesson showed his love for his mother and his respect for her. And it showed Jesus' compassion for people in whatever situation they in, you know, and willing to help, whatever the help would entail.
Absolutely. I think when we look at it and we try to justify it, and sometimes, again, people, you know, feel like they got to apologize for God doing this, you know. It's like, you know, he doesn't need our apologies, you know. He doesn't need us to stick up for him, you know, and make apologies for him doing something. You know, and I think we lose track of what the real issue is really all about with it. Lynette?
Part of the scripture also says that, you know, the wine was the best wine.
Mm-hmm.
And so this shows that, because we just studied this in KFC with the kids, Jesus...
Oh, you did, huh?
Jesus doesn't just give us something. He
right.
gives us the best.
Best.
So he just didn't, I mean, he does that through everything
yeah.
that he gives us. God gave us Jesus. He gave us the best. So when Jesus gives us something, it's not just grape juice, okay? It's the best. It's the best,
absolutely.
Whether it's grape juice or anything else.
Or fermented drink, yeah. Okay, Steve?
Well, I can't resist being a chemist. grape juice. Pretty much any fruit juice, but grape juice, what we're talking about here, absent our modern preservation methods,
it's going to ferment.
It's going to ferment,
right.
And it doesn't take long to do it.
Right.
Okay, 2 or 3 days, you got alcohol. Comes from bacteria in the air, natural yeast. Now we've learned as people to parse the yeast down. We have really, really good yeast that will take a really, really sweet grape, and the barrier there is 16%. Okay, that's the most you can push a grape in terms of its alcohol content in yeast. At that point, the yeast will die. Fermentation will stop. Okay. That's enough to get drunk on. 16% alcohol is plenty. If you choose to get inebriated, okay, to get drunk very quickly. Probably the alcohol content back then wouldn't have been that high because, you know, fermentation was a mystery. You put the new wine into the new wine skin, and the wine skin swells up.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get it, but it makes pretty good wine. Okay.
Right.
The banquet master actually made the comment, you know, that you've broken tradition here. You save the best wine to the end, where most people serve the best wine first, and then they bring out the inferior wine
after
the guests have had too much to drink.
Not tasting whether it's bad wine or good wine.
Yeah, now what's the bad wine there? The inferior wine is the wine that has gone to vinegar. That's a separate class of bacteria.
Right.
Once you hit the alcohol, okay, that bacteria dies, new bacteria gets in there. And that doesn't take very long either. You end up with red wine or with wine vinegar, you know, whatever color you drink that. And that's the reference to the inferior wine. It's the wine that's already started to go a little rancid.
Yeah, it's gone past its age.
It's gone past its prime.
Yeah.
And that has really nothing to do with Christ and his working this miracle in terms of an individual choosing, you know, to get, you know, drunk. You know, that's a completely
Well, and if any of you ladies that, you know, prepare the communion trays and everything, and, you know, somebody forgets and leaves the trays out there on the counter all week long, you ever gone in there and found, well, somebody left the trays out? Whoo, boy. Well, you know, that's grape juice that started fermenting, okay? You know, But, you know, again, I think that we have to make sure that we don't lose sight, again, of what's the real story about. And that's the sad thing about this story is that so many people have, you know, lost the real message of it because they get caught up and tied up on all of the, you know, the whole whether it's alcohol or not and, you know, and what Jesus did and shouldn't have done and blah, blah, blah. You know, and I think that it's, again, because we have certain preconceived ideas that may be cultural. They're our beliefs that we have and so forth, and we try to impose them upon the Scriptures, and they don't fit, folks. They just don't fit, okay? You know, some of you know about this event that took place when our daughter got married, you know, we had a wedding, you know, reception and so forth, and we had a member of the church from years way back that contacted us. I got a message on our, this is back when we had still an answering machines, by the way, so I'll tell you how long ago it was. You know, came home one day and there was a message from this person on our answering machine. I hadn't talked to him in decades, literally, and left me. So I called him back and said, "Hey, what's up?" He said, "Oh, I got a question I need to ask you." "Okay, what is it?" "That I understand at your daughter's wedding you served alcohol and you had dancing." I said, "Well, there was a bar there at the place where we had the wedding reception, but it wasn't open. We didn't serve any alcohol, you know, to anybody." My wife reminded me later on that, you know, the wedding couple actually toasted with real champagne. You know, I'd forgotten about that. You know, it wasn't an issue. It was just the two of them that did it. It was like, okay. But the other thing was, you know, you had dancing. And I said, "Yeah, we did. In fact, we took lessons so we could learn how to do ballroom dancing well," you see. It was a party. It was a celebration, you see. But my point is that I think sometimes our brethren get caught up on legalities of things that are really ridiculous, you see. And we try to then impose certain rules and restrictions on folks that don't have anything to do with biblical concepts. You say, and we make laws where there is no law, and then try to bind those on people. And the sad thing is, again, we lose sight of what the real message really is here. Brian, one more comment, and then we're going to move on here. Exactly. Exactly.
We're adding these laws.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Take care of people. Okay? Judy.
I just was going to bring up, coming from Europe, there are so many cultures like France, Germany, and other cultures that do serve an alcoholic beverage with a meal because it aids the digestive part of the food. Now, you put yourself in a party thing. People eat all kinds of foods. And so, yeah, alcohol would be served in these countries. And it would be very insulting to refuse this with a meal. You know, and children are raised on how to deal with this.
Right.
So you have not as high of a drunkenness percentage in the population because they have been taught and have been raised on how to use alcohol in a proper way.
Let me finish the last point in this whole thing, and it's creativity. One of the tools in Jesus' toolbox was creativity. He was very creative. In fact, you know, it's as Brother Lynn Anderson says, it's a one-of-a-kind original. Okay? Jesus balanced real needs with felt needs. Okay? People's real need is spiritual. Okay? That's the real need that people have. But sometimes what we have to do, and I think this is an example of Jesus doing that, sometimes we have to meet the felt need first, say, in order to be able to meet the real need. So here is a felt need. We have no more wine. Okay? You know, if Jesus would have addressed that issue the same way that he addressed the next one that we're going to be talking about, then, you know, the outcome would have been completely different. See? There was a felt need. There was a pending disaster that was about to take place. Okay? Did Jesus making more wine move these folks any closer to God spiritually? You say? Well, indirectly, I think it at least opened the door to that possibility. You say? But it was a felt need that he took care of. See? That then enables the real need to be addressed. And I think that that's an important lesson for us to learn. You see, that we deal with people all the time who have, you know, needs, felt needs. This is what I need. Well, it may not necessarily be what they need, the most important thing, but if we ignore that, then we might not ever get a chance to address the real need, the spiritual need. You see? And I think that's something that Jesus demonstrated here. Somebody had a hand up. Ted?
In verse 11, it says, this beginning of signs Jesus did at Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed it. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't Jesus' immediate agenda, but it turned out to be to his glory.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so we know at least the disciples knew what happened. Whether somebody mentioned earlier whether the bride and groom ever knew what happened, don't know for sure, but we know at least the disciples did.
Well, also the servants knew what Jesus was doing, you know. So, and it really manifested his power among them as well.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they talked about it.
Yeah, can you hear the buzz back in the kitchen? We put water in those jugs. How do you do that? You know, trying to figure that out.
Yeah, you can easily envision some of those people, you know, later on going after to hear Jesus. Remember that guy that turned the water? Yeah, well, he's back. He's out here on the mountainside. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Where he was able to address the real needs. See, you know, with people. All right. Okay, any other thoughts on that particular story before we finish up? Wes? Well, and again, I think that, you know, the problem comes when we try to use this story either, you know, on the one hand as justification that, you know, it's okay for us to drink all we want. On the other hand, you know, to try to, you know, feel like we have to make excuses and, you know, and so forth for Jesus making wine. You know, again, either one of those positions ends up missing the point of the story and what it's really all about. And so I think we really need to understand it that way. And look at it for what the point of the message really is, that Jesus is concerned about people. He's concerned about us. And he takes care of our needs because he loves us. okay, and not have to worry about getting caught up in all of the other issues and aspects that people bring into all of this and so forth. I don't find any embarrassment whatsoever and feel like I have to make excuses for God because Jesus made wine. Okay, you know, it's just, you know, it's not there, okay? We have to accept it and just, you know, quit focusing on that and focus on the real intent of the story. You see, and so forth. Okay, let me tell you where we're going to go. Just kind of give you a little bit. We've got a couple more minutes here. We're going to look at two stories, and this is a part called Insiders and Outsiders. The story of Nicodemus, okay, and the story of the woman of Samaria, the woman at the well. Okay, we're going to look at these two stories, and just in part of this is really looking at the idea that no two people are alike. What that means is that Jesus demonstrated how to approach the same topic, which really has to do with real needs, okay? How does he approach that very same topic differently with two different people? And what can we learn from Jesus and how he approaches Nicodemus in John chapter 3 and the Samaritan woman at the well in John chapter 4? What I want to encourage you to do is to read both of those stories between now and next week. We'll begin, the major focus is going to be beginning next week. We'll be focusing on the story of Nicodemus. If we get to the woman at the well, fine, but we'll do Nicodemus first. But I want you to look at both of those stories and see, you know, what are some of the similarities between these two people, but also what are a lot of the differences? What's the contrast between these two people? And look at how does Jesus deal with each of them? Okay? What are the things that you notice about them? Both of these people needed the same thing, but they needed it in a different way. Okay? And Jesus met both needs, but he met them very differently. Okay? So that's where we're going to go. That's what we will we'll focus on that. So read those two stories between now and then, and we'll discuss that. All right? Thank you all very much. Appreciate you.